This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Confringe reading series.
Right, so it is time for the second half of our little flash fiction festival, and our first reader is going to be Louise Geffen.
Hi, I'm not entirely sure what this genre is, but someone said magic realism, so I'm hoping it's that. This is called The Gnome. He belonged to my half-sister. She's younger than me. I hate them, she said one day. I only took him because the kids insisted. Do you want him? He gives me the creeps, but he's just your sort of thing. And he might cheer you up, you know, what with everything that's been going on. Thanks, I replied, ignoring the euphemism she'd used to describe 2 years of hell, and ignoring the fact that she appeared not to have noticed that I didn't have a garden in which to put a gnome. But I am the one in the family that keeps the cast-offs, the photos, mementos, letters no one reads. I thought the gnome could join the chipped teapot with the collection of mismatched cups and saucers that relatives have neither wanted to keep or throw away because they belong to Aunt such and such or Uncle so and so. I have a cup and saucer from each of the households of the last two generations, as well as chipped whimsies, a porcelain ballet dancer with just the faintest crack running through her tutu, and a baby's long black lace gown with matching bonnet. That was made for me when my mother died. For as long as I can remember, the gnome had been in the family, moving from one garden to another as relatives downsized, died, or moved into nursing homes. He was a little battered, but still looked up to me as he'd always done when I visited wherever he was. I set him on the kitchen table. The clover detail on his mandolin made me think of green fields and the hills sloping down to the river behind the village where my parents grew up. His turquoise hat and waistcoat were faded, but his boots were black as soot with silver buckles. I got used to him being on the kitchen table. When I came in from work, I talked to him, told him about my day. I started looking forward to coming home, sharing. I'd been living alone for some time. One night, a few weeks after my half-sister had dropped him off, I was woken by a mournful tune being plucked on strings. I got up, went into the kitchen. The music stopped. All was still. A pale moon shone through the window. I went back to bed, fell asleep, was woken later by the same sound, then echoes, a singing. Once more, I got up, went into the kitchen. The sound stopped as I stepped in. All was still. I went back to bed, lay with my eyes open, strained to hear. It was just soft, a gentle plucking on strings, a calling. This time I crept to the kitchen, but didn't step over the threshold. Bright light shimmered around the gnome as he played his mandolin. He was singing, the kitchen was filled with light, and people passing in a somber line, as if they were in a film projected onto the wall. I recognised my parents' village, the church on the hill with its stone steps leading down to the river. I recognised the faces, uncles, aunts, grandparents, long dead, leaving the church. At the head of the procession, a man in mourning attire carried a baby dressed in a long black-laced gown. The baby was pulling at his beard. Behind them walked a young boy, dressed in a turquoise hat, waistcoats, and boots as black as soot with silver buckles. A mandolin hung from his shoulder. Daddy, he said, carry me too. No one took any notice of him. As everyone made their way onto the green in front of the church and took their seats at a banqueting table, he took the path around the side of the church, sat beside an unmarked, unconsecrated grave, and looked down to the river. I followed the direction of his gaze. A woman lay under the water. Large stones tied around her waist anchored her in place. Her hair flowed and tugged, her skin mottled. The boy took the mandolin from his shoulder and began to pluck the strings. His mournful tune blended with the gnomes. As he played, the woman stirred. Her eyes opened. Her lips moved. She held her arms out to him, smiled. He looked around as if checking no one was watching, then ran down the hill, bright-eyed, excited. Mummy! When he reached her, he leaned out over the water, strained to hear what she was saying. Mummy, mummy, he called out, then lost his footing and slipped into the cold depths. He struggled to keep his head up, but he was small and was soon overcome by the cold and fatigue. His mandolin floated downstream. As the last bubbles of air from his mouth surfaced, the woman smiled and whispered, "Come here, my son." I stepped forward. The images vanished. The music stopped. All was still. In the pale moon, the gnome was silent, bright-eyed, looking up at me. The only sounds were my beating heart and the water dripping from the brim of his hat. Thank you.
I'm not sure if that classifies as magic realism because it wasn't in Spanish, but we'll give you a pass on that one. It's now my turn. This story is going to be in an anthology called The Girl at the End of the World, Volume 2, which will be published by Fox Spirit Books later this year. I thought I would make up for the lack of death and destruction in all of the other stories that we've had thus far. The story is called The Dragon's Maw, and that's M-A-W, not M-O-R-E. It's a mouth. Mine is the last voice this universe will ever hear. I have recordings, of course. My flagship carries within it the cultural histories of 1,000 civilizations. I could urge myself forward with rousing speeches of the greatest of leaders. I could play stirring martial music from those warlike of peoples. Or I could listen instead to the voices of my followers, my friends, my family, now all taken from me. I choose none of these things. I go forward instead, accompanied by the roar of a beast that has become dear to me. My flagship is named Lioness, and I go into battle on her as I have always done. I am Ishtar, Queen of Heaven, and I fear no one. It was not always thus. Mine is a long life, almost as long as that of the universe itself. In the beginning, when Tiamat, the Dragon of Chaos, gave birth to all things, I was there. When gas clouds gave birth to stars, when stars gave birth to planets, when planets gave birth to oceans, and when oceans gave birth to life, I was there. I was there when life gave birth to thought. I was there when thought gave birth to language. And I was there when language gave birth to civilization. I was there when people first knew to worship me. What tales they told. My loves, my battles became legendary. Above all, I fought against my sister, Ereshkigal, Queen of the Dark. Death herself was my enemy. What I gave, she took away to hide from sight and obsess over. She was a collector, my sister. She wanted everything. I only wanted to make things, but she wanted to have them. And have them, she did. The dead shall outnumber the living. That was the threat she made. Everything I created, she took and hoarded. One day, they said, she will bring them back. Her army. Where is your collection now, O sister? What remains of the dead? Like everything else. They are torn, limb from limb, flesh from bone, membrane from cell, atom from molecule, quark from proton. The dead cannot outnumber the living because there are no dead anymore. There is only me. And I am not dead. Yet. No, the dead are not quite all gone. One of them rides with me. Mostly they are gone because I needed energy. The dead cannot fight for me, not even dead gods, but I can fight with them, with what I make from them. From chaos we came, and to chaos we return. Only one corpse could I not bear to feed to the furnace. Tammuz, heart of my heart, giver of life to my creations. Oh, we fought, of course. The stories tell of that. Over so many aeons, who would not? Besides, we were gods. It was our function to be everything that mortals might be. Is there a world in which no man has ever cheated on his wife, as mine did? When a woman has ever coveted her sister's husband, as mine did? When a cousin's wife ever took revenge? Maybe the universe would have been better if there had been. Maybe it would still exist. But I doubt it. I think it would be lifeless. We fought, then. But we loved more, in many different guises. We wore so many masks on so many worlds, I've forgotten more than I remember. The databases remember them, but soon they too will be gone. In the final battle, everything that flies with me will be destroyed. It was, inevitably, a matter for philosophers. Would the world we knew grow and learn forever, or would it shrink back into the void from whence it came? So brave these mortals were to ask themselves questions that could only be answered over the lifetime of gods. In the end, of course, this end, it has all become clear. How long have we been fighting the last battle? How long since the first galaxies began to wink out of existence? How long since we admitted to ourselves that the end was inevitable, that the slow decline was irreversible? Again, I cannot remember. It seems like I've been fighting forever. And yet, I remember a time when it was not so. Those memories remind me why I fight. Who is my enemy? Tiamat, of course. The Dragon of Chaos did not die giving birth. Instead, her essence was spread throughout the universe. Part of her lurked at the heart of every galaxy and sat there, dark and brooding, waiting until thermodynamics favoured her once more. And she fed. Bit by bit, star by star, she consumed her children. Then, having eaten a whole galaxy, she sought out other parts of herself to join together as one once more. There she is now, on the screens of the Lioness. This is all that remains of the universe. I cannot see her, of course. Nothing escapes her grip, not even light. The last few clouds of gas spiral helplessly towards her, unable to escape the mouth that has eaten all that there is to eat. Their death agonies illuminate her position. Before long, they too will be gone, and there will be only her and me. She has a mouth, and I have a weapon. I call it a spear, for I wish it to fly straight and true. I call it time, though truthfully, it is far more than that. Over the centuries, Lioness and I have gathered the energies of dead galaxies and gods. I have built engines the like of which have never been known before. So much has been sacrificed to give me the power that I need. And now, it is time to strike. When nothing else remains, when I am the only thing that exists outside of the Dragon's Maw, I shall ignite those engines. Lioness will become my spear, and I shall cast her into the very center of the maelstrom. I have the energy I need and more. My machines have calculated that carefully for me. With that energy, I shall rip through the very heart of Tiamat. I shall take all that she has eaten, that solid pearl of everything that is the core of her being, and carry it with me to freedom. I am Ishtar, Queen of Heaven, and very soon now, I shall give birth to a whole new universe. Justin.
Okay, well, this is a short story called The Hiding Place. I better give you some context for it. If you know of it, it's inspired, so to speak, by a card in the major arcana of the tarot, if you know what that is. Okay? Right. I track her footprints through the forbidding forest to a tunnel at the base of a mountain. The cliff face is sheer, the rock black, red, volcanic. A pool of murky water to one side reflects the pale shimmer of a horned moon. I crouch in the undergrowth, watching, waiting. Dark blotches daubed around the tunnel entrance. Is that blood? To ward people away? Or keep them in? There are no guards at the entrance. I walk right in and free her. Someone or something has ripped her from the sanctity of life. But who or what? And why was she taken? What's she done? What's she not done? I scuttle towards the tunnel, pause at the entrance. Gloomy in there. Fear grips my throat, limbs heavy as teak. Won't be stopped now. Water dripping, slippery underfoot, back hard against the walls. I creep along the tunnel. Suddenly there's movement behind me, people shouting, howling, screaming, help, save me. The cry is as thick as night. They're bringing more prisoners. I duck behind a rock, suck in my breath. Clothes stick to me like leeches. Can they smell my fear? I hope it'll mingle with the terror of the captives. They're edging closer. I wait to hear the crack of a whip, the vicarious use of a club. Nothing. They pass me by, shadows furtive on the wall, their plaintive cries reverberate along the tunnel. I see no guards, but they must be there. I hear the chink of metal. They're chained together, one to another, a chain gang. I count. 15. I let the sounds of terror fade before I move a muscle. I slink out from behind the rock and meet a wall of rancid fear. It's palpable. Like sulphur overwhelming. A gag. I stagger on, bile sour in my throat, ahead a faint glimmer of light, the end of the tunnel. I kneel, glance around the corner. It's an enormous cavern, lit by a dim, flickering torchlight. I hear anguished cries, chained to a huge, circular rock in the middle of the cavern, are legions of humans. Young and old, male and female, rich and poor, vicious and virtuous, the do-gooders, the do-badders, and the do-nothingers. The beast is there, sitting cross-legged atop the rock, oozing darkness from every pore. White goatee beard, horns jut from his forehead, long goat snout. Man body, tree trunk thighs give way to hooved feet, holds the torch. A ewe green slime drips off his putrescent skin, gathers in a slough below him, and coagulates into the rock on which he sits. Arrogant, imperious, soulless eyes look towards me, I dive for cover. Has he seen me? My stomach twists. He crows. I belong to you. I belong to you. I belong to you. What's he talking about? He's demented. The new captors pull and yank on the chains that bind them to the face of the rock. Escape is futile, he sneers. They say the beasts are behemoth, older than sin. His ways more subtle than the moon. Beneath his ever-watchful gaze, she's there, somewhere, trapped, helpless. And there's only me. How to rescue her? Does he sleep? Is he human? No, he's not. Can't let that stop me. Can't leave her. Not now. Come too far. His litany continues. You're here because you wanted to come. I didn't compel you. No, that's not true. That's another lie. He's born of lies. He lives in the unseen. He's cast a spell on them. Darting through the shadows, I move from rock to rock. I catch sight of her. She's there. Relief. I try and catch her attention, but she doesn't see me. Instead, gazes right through me. I sneak up to her, hands held fast to the rock by round chains of dull grey iron. She's pained, tortured. Momentarily, I faint from the stench of the decaying sloth. I come round and whisper, I can set you free. Come with me. She ignores me. She doesn't even see me. She's in his spell, that's why, I convince myself. I must help. I grab a rock from the ground and smash it against the iron ring. It rebounds off it. The retort echoes around the cavern, slowly recedes. Sweaty hands gripping the rock, I aim again. Try, I yell at her, pull the ring from the rock. Her lips move, she's saying something. Wait, I can't hear what. Loosen it, I cry. Release yourself from this bondage. She frowns. I can't. Why? I look again at the iron ring and the placement of her hands, and then I realise. She's not chained at all. She's hanging on of her own free will. That's why no guards at the entrance, on the chain gang, nor any enforcers in the cave. I'm bewildered. You can leave at any time. You're free. Just let go. I urge her. I don't want to, she yells. Don't ever try and release me. I'm staying here. She kicks me in the stomach, winding me. I told you, the beast growls. I am their fear. He stubs out the torch. The light fades, shadows looming on the cavern walls. She needs help. I can do something good here. In the faint light, I grab her hand, pull her towards me. But she's holding on to the iron ring for dear life. She's got the strength of a man, a beast. She squeezes my hand, tearing the flesh. I yell. I can barely see her now. The torch is nearly extinguished. I can get her to let go. One last attempt. With my free hand, I reach above and grasp her hand that's clutching the iron ring. If I can get her to loosen her grip, I can pull her away from the clutches of the beast. In the murky darkness, I miss her hand and inadvertently grab the iron ring. My fingers close around it. I try and loosen them. My fingers won't move. I'm clinging to the rock. No, I'm chained to my own fears. I can't give them up either. Otherwise, I'd be empty. Nothing. No one. Thank you very much.
And finally, Peter.
Yeah, I'll play.
It's always to play. So usually, traditionally, it's you leave the best to last. So we're going to break with tradition. I wrote something new for this specifically. In fact, I wrote two things and I sent them both to Kevlin. And
I'm really happy to play.
He is getting the blame, yep. And he's chosen the more difficult one to read out. This is called Roadkill. One. There is a pause of a few minutes. Two. I'm annoyed and curious. What you doing? I say. Counting. I can see that. What you counting? Three. He gives me a sharp look. Them. I follow where my little brother is pointing out of the back window and see a red splash, what might be black feathers and a limp, disappearing behind us on the side of the road, lurid in the backlights. Ew, gross! Mum, he's counting dead things. Be nice to your brother Mikey. Wrote words, said with no inflection. She's not really thinking. She's concentrating on the road. I almost say, but Mum! When I see her glance in the rearview mirror. Her eyes make me stop. It's not my fault the whole day was crap. Why do we go to the alleyway anyway? Without Dad. With Granny. I cross my arms. What a crap idea. What a crap holiday. Four. You've got to be kidding. There's no way they've seen four dead things. I start. But he gives me the look. It's not right to be frightened of your little brother, is it? Although, if anyone ever said that to me, I'd punch their lights out. It's a good job he likes me. Five. I look behind the car. I can't tell where it is, but it's all bloated and strange, and its legs are sticking up in the air like antennas. He looks at me smugly. Granny is snoring in the front. She and Mum are the only ones, apart from me, that seem to be able to talk to him without him freaking out. That's why I call him the horror. Six. Seriously? He gives me a look, with his eyes almost rolling up into his head, and makes a face. I know better than to argue. Why don't you boys try and get some sleep? Mum says. So I close my eyes, all the better to ignore the little horror. Seven. That's a secret never to be told, isn't it, Mum? Uh-huh. Isn't it, Mikey? I turn my back and make sleepy noises. Never to be told. He murmurs, quite close to my ear. I do my best to ignore him. The sound of the wheels on the tarmac lulls me. I am comfortable. I drift off. The last thing I hear is, eight. Later, I wake, sweaty and confused. It is quiet. Why have we stopped? There's a lorry on the side of the road with its full beams and hazards on. In front of it, lying down and apparently nonchalantly chewing the cud, is a cow. Why is there a cow on the road? Shh, go back to sleep. Need to go pee. Mikey, take your brother to go to the toilet. I sigh and get out of the car. I walk all the way around the trailer, which holds all of our camping stuff, and open the door. He is waiting. I take his hand and we walk over to the hedge. Not here. Granny can see. I turn to look, and sure enough, Granny is looking out of the window, seemingly at us, although you never can tell what's going on in Granny's head, or if she's looking now, or in the past, or even the future. She's not been the same since Dad... Well, since it happened. Oh, come on, then. I take him deeper into the bushes. Turn around. We've played this game before. I know my part. I turn and look at the road, and notice a set of headlights approaching fast. I see the lorry driver, or maybe it's the farmer, standing in the middle of the road. He's trying to flag down the car. It's going too fast. It swerves to miss him and ploughs straight into our trailer. There's an almighty bang, and I see the trailer disintegrating. And our car goes up on its front wheels, then back down with another bang. I leave the horror and run to the car. It's a mess. If we'd been in the back, we'd be dead. Gran has lost her teeth and is bent down in the footwell looking for them. Mum looks white as a sheet. I stare at the car that hit ours. It's big. A Rover or a Mercedes or something. The guy staggers out. The car is skewed across the road, partially blocking the lights from the truck. Who the fuck decides to park on a fucking tiny fucking country road? He starts, slurring his words, like Dad used to when he got home late. Is everyone all right? I decide he is the farmer. He looks like one. Mummy's just getting out of the car. She looks at me. You're all right. It's a statement, not a question. I look round for the horror. He stood just behind me, staring at the mess. Our stuff's all over the road. 9. I look at him without understanding, then slowly turn to look at the road. A man's car has smashed into ours, bounced off and hit the cow. He looks up at me. 9 is for hell, he says. He looks over at the man, and 10. 10 is for the devil's own self. He takes my hand as the man slumps down on the road, pulling at his collar. Mum and the farmer are by the man's side. He's got a funny colour. I can tell that even from where I'm standing. He's making small choking sounds that I can hear between my mum saying, are you okay? What's happening? It's just like Paul. Can't you do something? Paul is my dad. Was my dad. I look at my little brother and he is staring at the man who's now lying down. My mum is shouting at the farmer, do something, for God's sake, do something, and crying. She used to cry a lot when Dad came home all shouty and slurry and had to teach her a lesson. The man is not moving. My mum is crying. I'm standing at the side of the road holding my brother's hand. He looks up at me and says, never to be told. Thank you.
Well, maybe we had a theme for the evening after all, various satanic influences. Anyway, that's all of our readings done, so we're going to take another short break for replenishing the glasses, and then we'll come back and have a few questions for our readers.
Bristol Con Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the Bristol Con Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.